This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hello, I'm Julian Warwicker. Thank you for downloading the BBC World Tonight podcast for Monday, the 28th of October. The Israeli parliament has passed a law that bans the UN's Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, from operating inside Israel, including East Jerusalem. The decision has passed despite warnings from many of Israel's allies. We'll have reaction from Israel and from outside. The cap on bus fares in England is rising from £2 to £3, a budget measure which Sir Keir Starmer announced in advance of Wednesday will explore its impact. And we ask if magicians, famously secretive about their methods, might be about to tell us more about the way they carry out their tricks. The United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees has been in operation since 1950. Its mandate has been repeatedly renewed by the UN General Assembly ever since, in the absence of a solution, it says, to the refugee issue in the Middle East. That mandate was most recently extended until June 2026. The organisation's relations with Israel have been difficult for a good while, but they've deteriorated significantly since the Hamas attacks on Israel last October, and tonight they've hit a new low. In a vote in the Israeli parliament, the Knesset, MPs have passed by large majorities two laws banning UNRWA from operating in Israel and in occupied areas under its control. Well, speaking just before the law was passed, a spokesperson for the U.S. State Department, Matthew Miller, said the U.S. was deeply concerned over the move.
There's nobody that can replace them right now in the middle of the crisis. So we continue to urge the government of Israel to pause the implementation of this legislation. We urge them not to pass it at all. And we will consider next steps based on what happens in the days ahead.
Well, the Foreign Secretary here, David Lammy, spoke on the proposal in Parliament today before it passed.
The allegations against UNRWA's staff earlier this week were fully investigated and offer no jurisdiction for cutting off ties with UNRWA. This weekend, we therefore joined partners in expressing concerns at the Knesset's legislation and urged Israel to ensure UNRWA's life-saving work continues.
Well, a number of other countries, including Ireland, Norway and Spain, have this evening also condemned the Israeli parliament's move. Juliet Tuma is the communications director at UNRWA, and she sent this voice note to the BBC.
The vote by the Israeli parliament or Knesset against UNRWA this evening is unprecedented. It sets a dangerous precedent. And it opposes the UN Charter and violates the State of Israel's obligation under international law. It's beyond a concern to all of us. It's a threat to our common humanity. The time to act is now. There's no more time to waste. Enough is enough. It's time for a ceasefire in Gaza. It's time to release the hostages. It's time to allow humanitarian agencies, especially UNRWA, the largest humanitarian organization, the backbone of the humanitarian operation for the past 1 year, just allow us to do our work. Enough. Enough.
Well, Sebastian Usher is our Middle East regional editor who's in Jerusalem. I asked him what were the principal arguments around this in the Knesset?
I mean, the debate, which went on for a couple of hours, was very strongly tilted against UNRWA and expressing what really has been building since October the 7th. That already been amongst parts of the Israeli political parties in parliament and in the Israeli government, you know, a long-standing sense that the UN and UNRWA are basically biased against Israel. And since October the 7th, that has really hardened, become much, much stronger. There have been accusations that 12 members of UNRWA were involved in the attacks on October the 7th. That was investigated. There was found evidence that 9 of them may have been involved. And there are also some issues about the neutrality. But in general, the main allegations by Israel were not found to be held up. But that hasn't changed the attitude that we heard in the Knesset, that UNRWA is essentially complicit with Hamas, that it's almost like a shield for Hamas, and that it is working against the interests of Israel. So it passed very easily, this vote. It was the third reading. The actual ban, and this is in Israel, well, that does include East Jerusalem, which is seen as being under the sovereignty of Israel, which is occupied territory, and from where UNRWA provides lots of services already, and also it's a conduit towards the occupied West Bank. The ban won't go into action for the next 3 months, but it's a big blow, undeniably, to UNRWA.
As you say, it passed easily, only 10 votes against, so dissenting voices were few and far between, were they?
Yes. I mean, I think that since UNRWA isn't really an honest partner in this, has just become really the central idea that people have here of its activities. That's very different from how much of the rest of the world sees it. The US State Department issued a statement as the vote was happening, essentially saying that the US had contacted the Israeli government to express its deep concern about this move. And we had the UK joining other countries such as Australia and Canada in expressing their concern that in such a desperate situation, humanitarian situation in Gaza at the moment, this could have devastating consequences for the people there.
Sebastian Usher in Jerusalem. Well, as he told me, there was a very comfortable majority in the Knesset in favour of this measure. Earlier, Boaz Bismuth, the Likud Knesset member and co-proponent of one of these bills, told me why he favoured its passing and why now.
UNRWA did not assist the terrorists on the 7th of October. UNRWA participated in the massacre of the 7th of October. We have many examples of people, who were registered in UNRWA, and in fact, we're Hamas terrorists. So how can you allow this organization to continue and function for your country?
But that was looked into, wasn't it? Those main Israeli allegations were looked into. They found some neutrality-related issues at UNRWA, determined that 9 employees may have been involved in the October the 7th attack, but they found no evidence for Israel's chief allegations there.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk facts, as you said. The fact, that underneath UNRWA offices, you would see Hamas tunnels and Hamas functioning over there. You will not tell me that UNRWA did not know about it.
Can we talk about the impact this will have? According to Philippe Lazzarini of UNRWA, the decision taken by the Knesset opposes the UN Charter, it violates the State of Israel's obligations under international law, and that as a result of it, Palestinians will suffer more. What do you say?
No. This is totally, totally, I don't even know how to define it, but everybody, you yourself know that it's wrong, and I'll tell you why.
UNRWA says more than 2 million people depend on life-saving aid from that organization. How are you going to help them?
Listen. First of all, you will find an alternative. An agency participated on the 7th of October. You wouldn't expect us, Israel, to work with such an organization, A. B, we do not want or wish to see a vacuum because Israel is fighting against terrorists, not against population. There were two bills. Mine was about closing offices of UNRWA in Jerusalem. Right. Meaning, I will supply what UNRWA used to do, which is water, which is health, which is, of course, education. Two things I would like to
do. Education for 650,000 girls and boys.
Do you know, sir, that we had 11 meetings before the bill was presented today? And in those meetings, we did not pass the bill until we knew that there are alternatives. Right. And believe me, all those children that went to school will continue to have education.
Are you saying that you will replace every single bit of aid that UNRWA says it currently provides for the Palestinians, and you will replace that as soon as UNRWA is unable to provide it because of what you've just decided to do?
I can guarantee you that there will not be a vacuum.
That's not quite the same thing, with respect.
There will not be a vacuum, meaning, Israel will supply all the need. And by the way,
all the need. Every single thing that's being provided now, according to UNRWA, will be provided by the Israelis.
Let's not lie to reality. Right now, we're at war in Gaza. Yet, Israel supplies so much humanitarian aid. We supply all the aid and all the things that UNRWA was supplying. Israel will do exactly the same thing. And I made sure about it because I said again, I'm fighting terrorists. I'm not fighting civilians. Well,
you have made that very clear, and it's important to hear that you will provide everything that UNRWA says it is now. You've just said that, and that's very important. In which case,
100% guarantee.
I heard it loud and clear. In which case, why are so many, even of your closest allies around the world so critical of this? The Americans in advance said, please pause the implementation of this legislation. David Lammy, the UK Foreign Secretary, has just said, today's Israeli Knesset bills restricting UNRWA are totally wrong. Why are they all so critical if what you have said is true?
I will answer. I heard your question. Maybe because they are worried, but for no reason. Because as you asked me a question, maybe they're worried that there will be a vacuum, but there will not be. And I have to tell you that ever since the 7th of October, international community and many of our friends were worried about, for example, entering Rafah. And they said, my God, how many civilians are going to die, which is not the case. You have to stop the war because otherwise, I mean, we cannot continue. And now we're making a lot of pressure to get back our 101 hostages. So many things, I mean, we're told not to do, or not to enter Lebanon, not to operate over there. Many things we're told not to do, and we know exactly what we have to do.
Do you acknowledge that if you don't deliver what you have said you will by replacing the levels of aid, that US warning that it could move to suspend some military aid to Israel if you do not do more regarding aid, is that now much more on the horizon for you than it was before as a result of this?
As I know that the services will be supplied, I'm not worried whatsoever. We're a serious country. We take care of population. We did it. And we, by the way, during our war in Gaza, look at the amount of quantity of humanitarian aid. If we do it during war, believe me, we shall do it where we have to do here under sovereignty of Israel.
Boaz Bismuth, the Likud member of the Knesset and co-proponent of the first of those two bills. Let's talk to Ricardo Pires, who's spokesperson for UNICEF and is on the line from New York. Ricardo Pires, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
What impact do you say this move will have?
Oh, it's huge. It's a big blow, as has been described. UNRWA is the backbone of the humanitarian response in the Gaza Strip. It has been for the last 13 months. Without their services, Palestinian refugees will lose a critical lifeline of services. And the children in Gaza, most particularly, who've been suffering and have been at the very sharp end of this crisis, will be put at even greater risk. So it's a very big blow, and we're very concerned.
You heard what Boaz Bismuth said there a moment ago, that the Israelis will pledge to do everything by way of aid that UNRWA are doing now.
Look, I can only speak for UNICEF, but as the leading children's agency, UN agency, we know that we need UNRWA in order to be able to perform our work and to deliver for children in Gaza and in the state of Palestine. The Palestinian people, especially children, need UNRWA to remain the indispensable and irreplaceable arm of the humanitarian response it has proven to be since the onset of this conflict 13 months ago. So UNRWA has been crucial in delivering life-saving aid to the Palestinians. We need them, from logistical support to warehouses to supporting with vaccination campaigns such as the one we're trying to carry out for polio now, but in the north of Gaza, it has become impossible due to conflict. So they are the backbone of our humanitarian response, and we need them to stay so.
Another Israeli voice has referred specifically to your organization as opposed to UNRWA. This is Sharon Haskell, who's an Israeli member for the National Right Party. She dismisses UNRWA because, for all the reasons that we heard from Boaz Bismuth a moment ago, but she said the World Health Organization or UNICEF have the facility, the logistics, and the experience to actually work through an operation like the one that UNRWA currently works on. Does she have a point?
Look, as I've said before, UNICEF and the Palestinian people, especially children, need UNRWA to remain the indispensable and irreplaceable arm of the humanitarian response it has proven to be. So UNICEF indeed can carry out humanitarian aid and delivery of supplies, as we have been in many other crises, not only in Gaza, but this one, given the scale and the expertise that UNRWA has on the ground and the years that it has been working in Gaza. No organization can pick up that work and continue without absolutely putting the lives of children and civilians at greater risk. So no, we cannot carry out that work, nor can other UN agencies, I believe, without UNRWA.
What do you anticipate will now happen at the United Nations by way of a political response to this?
Well, I think there will be a pushback to review this bill, and hopefully there will be a political solution to this, or a diplomatic solution But we are very concerned that indeed all efforts that have been made so far in the field of diplomacy hasn't really provided the results that we would like to see, given the amount of children and civilians that keep dying day after day across Gaza in horrific ways.
Grateful for your contribution. Thank you. Ricardo Pires, spokesperson for UNICEF, on the line from New York. Now, coming up later on The World Tonight.
You're really going to like this. Not a lot, but you're going to like it. You see, a lot of people would see this and think this is the trick. But this is the real secret of the trick.
Should magicians ever reveal their secrets? We'll speak live to one who thinks sometimes they should. Now, another day and another release of budget information prior to Rachel Reeves' set piece speech in the Commons on Wednesday. Today's news concerned the cost of bus fares in England, currently capped at £2 per journey. There had been speculation in recent days that the Chancellor would announce in the budget that the current cap would be scrapped. This would have meant that some passengers would face a steep hike in fares following 2 years of help. This morning, the Prime Minister, Sir Keir Starmer, looked to clarify things.
I do know how much this matters, particularly in rural communities where there's heavy reliance on buses. And that's why I'm able to say to you this morning that in the budget we will announce there'll be a £3 cap on bus fares to the end of 25, because I know how important it is. So that'll be there in the budget on Wednesday.
Well, the rise in the cap to £3 will affect most bus users. There are 3.4 million of them, apart from those travelling in London or in Greater Manchester, where the funding structure is different. These bus users in Coventry today were not happy about the rise.
It's going to be too much. £3 is too much for a single fare.
You see, people who's using buses, they're using buses for a reason, because they can't afford cars. I can't afford to have a car because insurance is horrendous.
With the cost of living the way it is at the moment, yes, I think, yes, we need to keep the cost of travelling down.
But Bill Hiron, chairman of the bus company Stevenson's of Essex, welcomed the move.
This is certainly good news for passengers. It means that passengers, particularly on the longer distance services, will carry on benefiting from a lower fare. And hopefully it's also good news for us as operators, because some of those extra passengers that have been generated by the lower cap will carry on travelling by bus, albeit at the slightly higher fare.
Well, I've been talking to Josh, a university student in Lancaster. He told me how much of an impact a bus fare rise on this scale would have on him.
I'm completely reliant on the bus service to get to campus and to get to my lectures. Normally, it's £4 a day, and I'm going in every day for lectures and to do work. So that's £20.
And each of those return journeys, obviously £4, that could well be £6 as a result of what the Prime Minister said today. What difference is that going to make to you?
It would mean that I'd be spending upwards of £30 a week on buses, not including weekends when I have to go in to do things. And that's equivalent to what I spend on my food shop, which is about a quarter of my budget a week. I feel like increasing the bus fare cap will just disincentivize people to use the buses. It doesn't make any sense economically or environmentally.
Listening to that is Claire Walters, who's the chief executive of Bus Users UK, which campaigns on behalf of bus passengers. Claire Walters, what's your reaction to what the Prime Minister said today?
Oh, it's terribly disappointing, isn't it? I mean, you can hear stories like this being repeated up and down the country everywhere you go. These are not, you know, frivolous expenditure. This is not something you can really choose to do. If you've got a job, you need to get there. And twice as many people get around in life by using the bus as any other form of public transport added together. So the bus is the main form of public transport. It's the most sustainable option most people have, because if you live more than a couple of miles away, you're probably not going to walk. And with this kind of weather, you're not going to cycle much either. It's dark.
How consistent a picture is there around the country on this, do you anticipate? I mean, will all fares, currently £2, go up to £3, or is it more complicated than that?
Oh, it's much more complicated than that. Nothing's easy in the bus world. There's a lot of opportunity for local authorities to do different things. But it depends if they've got any cash. They're not required to spend anything at all on buses. And that, other than obviously the disabled pass and the concessionary passes, they have to do a certain amount of that. But everything else is all optional. So all our lives was kind of based on being able to get places. And that's not always an option. As your caller was just saying, it's just going to massively increase the cost of getting to anything.
You're aware of the government arguments here that savings have to be made for all the reasons that they have outlined. And this is one area where they can save some money. Do you have any sympathy at all for that argument?
Well, obviously, people have got to balance their budgets, but I'm not an economist. But it strikes me that the last people you want to be trying to get to tighten their belts are people whose belts are already meeting in the middle. They are not the obvious target for the people, you know, to get the money to fill the fiscal hole that they have.
Just expand that thought in terms of who you think will be worst hit.
Yeah. I think what you're going to end up with is an awful lot of young people trying to get to their first jobs. You're going to have people who are trying to visit folk in hospital, people who can't drive because of medical conditions who have to go on the bus, maybe to get treatment. And it just feels like these are the people already reeling from an awful lot of economic problems. Not necessarily to do with this government, obviously, but they are already here, those problems. And they need to not be exacerbated by this government then adding on another pressure that they could do without.
Claire Walters, thank you very much for coming on. Dan Norris is with us, the Mayor of the West of England, Combined Authority and Labour MP for North East Somerset and Hannam. Good evening to you.
Good evening, Julia.
You heard Claire Walters. What would you say to her?
Well, I am sympathetic to what she said, but I think the reality is that we've got to face some serious challenges. First of all, we've got really public finances in real difficulty, and we also want to make sure that we have a bus service in the future. And that requires a number of things, in my view. Firstly, the fare cap at £3, as put out by Keir Starmer today, is a very important move and a good move.
It's a 50% rise for some people, as our student explained.
That is true, but the bus industry has had 40% inflation over the last couple of years. It's been particularly hard hit more than other areas. So in some ways, the £3 cap that's just been announced is in some ways more generous than the £2 cap when it was announced 2 years ago. So I think we have to see it as a combination of being careful about the public finances, but also being compassionate to those who are really dependent on buses, particularly in rural areas and towns.
It won't save a huge amount of money, will it?
It's hard to know how much it will save. It's a very complicated thing.
Well, it's certainly not £22 billion, is it? Nowhere near it.
Well, no, it's certainly not that, but I think it's a question of every area has to take its carry its weight, I think. We are facing such real challenges in so many areas with the public finances, and I think that this is a fair compromise between providing support for those who most need it and also recognising the genuine plight that the nation's got at the moment.
What of the point that Claire Walters made about the fact that people who've already tightened their belts will be the ones worst hit by this? And also, you surely want to encourage bus travel for environmental reasons, she said. So why discourage it in this way?
Well, I think the danger is that if you think that the answer to everything is to subsidise buses, and I mean, I, as mayor, have had to subsidise buses that cost £140 per journey, would you believe, in some rural areas. That's clearly not sustainable. So you can't allow that to carry on forever. What you need is new and different ways of doing things. And I've been doing that as a regional mayor in the West of England, doing something called the Birthday Bus Pass, which is free travel for everybody within that area, 1 million people in the month of their birthday. And that has turned out to be very successful. It's just been assessed independently as being very good value for money. It's increased the number of people who are using buses. It's reduced the number of people who are reliant on cars and using cars. So it's environmentally friendly. It reduces pollution. It helps get rid of the congestion that we have in my region, which is very costly to business. And it allows the poorest in society to use the bus for free when they're most reliant on it. So they get, in effect, a 12th off their annual bill for transport. So you can do it. You can square the circle and get lots of advantages and benefits. But if you carry on just subsidising however much it costs, you'll end up putting bus services in decline, in my view.
I mentioned London. I mentioned Greater Manchester. Would the West of England Combined Authority go down that road, have a separate structured financial arrangement whereby this cap might not have to come into effect where you are as compared with other places?
Well, we kind of do that in the west of England already. We have a £2 fare.
And that stays, does it?
Well, it will depend. I'll have to look at the books now, of course, because every change has a knock-on. But look, Labour Metro mayors 2 years ago got together and decided to set the £2 fare cap, which I was part of. The then Tory government quickly copied and introduced it right across the country. And now it's going because it was only funded to the end of this year. So the Labour government is having to face the reality of government policy over the last 14 years and deal with the challenge in a compassionate and as fair a way as possible. And it's not easy. But I do think the £3 fare cap announced by Keir Starmer today is the right compromise with balancing the books and being fair to people.
Dan Norris, thank you very much indeed for coming on. With the US presidential election just over a week away, it's comments by a comedian at a Donald Trump rally in Madison Square Garden in New York last night, which have made headlines. The comic Tony Hinchcliffe made a series of jokes that lent on racist stereotypes and prompted criticism from some Republicans as well as Democrats. In this one, he singled out the island of Puerto Rico.
It is absolutely wild times. It really, really is. And, you know, there's a lot going on. Like, I don't know if you guys know this, but there's literally a floating island of garbage in the middle of the ocean right now. Yeah. I think it's called Puerto Rico. Okay. All right. Okay. We're getting there.
Well, the Trump campaign has distanced itself from the comedian's comments. The Harris campaign has attacked the rally as, quote, dangerously divisive. In a moment, we'll ask if this kind of stand-up routine will change voting intentions. First, though, to Clarissa Martinez, who is vice president of the Latino Vote Initiative at Unidos US, the largest national Latino civil rights and advocacy organization in the United States. Clarissa, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
When you look at Latino voters in this election, and one is always reluctant to lump everybody together under that kind of heading, how important are they?
The Hispanic voters are going to be decisive in the U.S. presidential election. They're definitely going to be decision makers in places like Arizona and Nevada. But given how razor thin the margins of victory are, they also are going to play a pivotal role in places like Pennsylvania and even others where they are smaller in number, but the margins are so small.
And when you look at the way Latino voters have tended to go in previous elections, have you seen a trend? Are they moving from one side to another over time?
Generally, the Latino voters have traditionally broken about two-thirds on the Democratic support, one-third on the Republican side. In the last 10 years, Republicans had lost some ground and Democrats benefited from that, but they didn't solidify it on their column. So now we're seeing in the last two cycles or so, Republicans recuperating some of that ground and actually gaining some points. So we'll see where they end up this cycle.
And why has that shift happened? What's the issue that's persuaded people to move across?
I think this is an election economy. The Hispanic electorate, a lot of folks are among working class families in the United States, and they have been hit very hard by inflation. And so I think that top of mind for these voters are economic issues. Four out of the top five issues are economic related. But at the same time, so that is putting some wind on the sails of Republicans. The bottom line is, if Latinos were the only voters in the United States, we would have an early result on election night, because I think if the trends hold, Latinos in every single state, except perhaps Florida, are going to end up on the Democratic column.
And will Tony Hinchcliffe's jokes make any difference, do you think?
You know, the thing about Trump is that he started his campaign in 2015 when he was running for president, making disparaging remarks about Hispanics. And he has created he opened the door and literally set the stage for this kind of rhetoric. Mm. I think that's known to many Hispanic voters, and to the ones that are new to the process, I do hope that they hear the people he hangs with.
Okay. We must leave it there, Clarissa. Thank you very much indeed. Well, Jim Messina was Barack Obama's deputy chief of staff at the White House and served as his campaign manager in 2012 before coming to Britain to advise David Cameron prior to the 2015 general election. I asked him if he thought the row over the comedian's comments at the Trump rally could have any influence on the campaign.
It could. There are 200,000 Puerto Rican voters in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania looks like it's going to be the tipping point state in our electoral college. And so if those voters get angry about what was said, that could change things.
Donald Trump and those close to him have distanced themselves from the specific remarks. Does that make any difference, do you think?
Not really, because the truth is the two campaigns have two different theories of the case. Trump is just trying to excite his base and get them motivated to vote. And the way you do that is throw red meat slogans to your supporters. And the Harris campaign thinks there's still swing voters out there who are trying to decide what to do. And so they have a different theory of how to make that case. It really is, from a political professional not involved on either side, incredibly interesting in what looks like a very tied race.
Does it say anything to you about the wisdom when you're organizing a big political event about inviting a comedian to stand on stage and say anything at all? Because I can think of a few examples in this country when that went badly wrong.
In 2008, when Barack Obama was running in the primaries and no one thought he could win, he had a comedian do a fundraiser and the comedian said some very inappropriate things. And forevermore, Barack Obama had the no comedians rule, which I thought was a very good rule and served us in good stead. Comedians are supposed to make you laugh by saying outlandish things. Politicians are not supposed to say outlandish things and not supposed to make you laugh, usually.
Let's talk about the Harris campaign. And you highlighted a moment ago her conviction that there are still swing voters out there. Do you think she's right about that?
I think there's a small number of swing voters out there, absolutely. You saw some numbers from an NBC poll over the weekend saying about 4% of Americans are undecided. Looks like they're breaking towards Vice President Harris, according to that poll and a couple other polls. It may be a little bit more voters than usual, considering Vice President Harris has only been in the race 94 days. She's had 3 months to make her case, so it would make sense that there's a few more voters who just don't know enough about her.
And when you see as much name-calling as you're seeing in both directions, how much does that edify or otherwise what's going on?
Well, the truth is, sadly, that people believe the negative. People are politically cynical and tend to believe what they hear if it's bad. If you have a daughter and a guy asks her out and 10 people tell you good things and one person tells you something bad about the kid, you're not going to let her go out with the kid because you're going to believe the negative. And so negative campaigning works for that reason, which I'm not sure clarifies the process much, but clearly allows people to get a very, very deep sense of these two candidates.
I mean, I wonder when you see terms like Antichrist thrown in one direction, that was said of Kamala Harris. She's certainly referred to Donald Trump as a fascist on a number of occasions. Tim Walz compared this Madison Square Garden rally to a 1939 pro-Nazi event. I mean, does that reflect on the person doing the name-calling worse, or does it hit home to those who are being accused of those things?
Well, look, both sides are trying very clearly to wake their sides up and say, hey, these other guys aren't in it for you. I tend to think the arguments are better made more dispassionately. And I think voters look at some of this rhetoric and say, hey, this just feels too much. It feels like it's BS. And so I'm not going to listen to it. As opposed to, I think, more compelling arguments are made by normal voters looking at the television saying, here's why I'm voting for Kamala Harris, or here's why I'm voting for Donald Trump. I think that's more effective. But the truth is, in a tied race, 8 days out, both sides are going to do what they think they have to do to win the presidency.
Jim Messina, 8 days before Americans vote.
Where's the ball? If the ball's in my left hand, it's in my left hand. If it's not in my hand, it's under the cup. If it's under the cup, it's not in my hand at all. If it's in that hand, it could be in that. If it's in that, it could be up there. If it's up there, it could be down there. If it's in the pocket at the same time, it could be up there at the same time. It's under the cup. Now, if the cup and the ball are scattered and the cup is empty, you can't have the ball. You got the ball in the cup, you can't be in the pocket. In the pocket, you can't be in the cup at the same time, it's under the cup. If, on the other hand, the ball and the cup are together, then the cup... You're not following this, are you?
the magician Paul Daniels performing his cup and ball routine. Well, he was a member of the Magic Circle, which has, since it was founded more than 100 years ago, been firm in its protection of the secrets of magicians. In other words, we mustn't know how they do their tricks. Now, though, a slightly more nuanced position is emerging among magicians, and it comes courtesy of the work of two academics who've asked hundreds of magicians from around the world about attitudes to what's known in the trade as exposure. There was a near unanimous view that exposing another magician's methods when they're still alive shouldn't happen. But there was a more relaxed view of giving away the secrets of a dead magician or of describing how an illusion was performed if it was one that you had developed yourself. Dr. Gustav Korn is an associate professor in psychology at the University of Plymouth and director of its magic lab. He was one of the two academics who conducted this research and is a magician himself. Gustav, welcome. Good evening.
Good evening.
How controversial a topic is this for magicians?
I think it's a hugely controversial topic. It's sort of the backbone of lots of magic societies. So if you join a magic society, you promise not to expose any magic secrets. But actually, there's very little known about what it really means to expose a magic secret. And that's really what the focus of this study was all about.
And some say you can in specific circumstances.
Well, it depends a bit. So we ran a big study which looked at the context in which magic secrets can be exposed. And so we asked lots of magicians, about 200 magicians. We also ran focus groups as well. And there are clearly certain situations in which magic tricks can be exposed. So, for example, if you pay for them, so if you pay to buy a magic trick, then it's completely acceptable to reveal the secret. But it's also more nuanced as well. So, for example, so we use magic to study the human mind, and indeed most magicians actually felt that in those kind of contexts, it is okay if it doesn't harm magic to reveal some of the secrets. Mm.
I mean, one thing that strikes me, I mean, the internet presumably is changing all of this anyway, because if we want to find out, we can.
Yeah, I mean, most secrets are available on the internet. So if people really want to know how a trick is done, they can just go and find out the secrets online. But the interesting thing is that most people don't.
I was about to suggest that, because we like the mystery, don't we? We like trying to work it out. We invariably can't work it out, but we like to try.
Yeah, we like to try. We like to try, but we don't really want to know. And indeed, that's really what magic is all about as well. It's about using illusions and misdirection to create the mystery that magic evokes.
Which presumably means this element of secrecy will pretty much stay as it is for the foreseeable future?
I think so. I mean, I guess sort of like the main focus is really for us to think about, well, what impact does the magic have on people's perception of magic? So we use magic in education, we use it in science as well. And so there, actually kind of like exposing certain small secrets can elevate the art of magic. But it also has a positive impact on people's appreciation for magic.
Thank you so much for coming on the programme, Dr. Gustav Korn. Just time for our closing headline. The Israeli parliament has passed a law banning the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees from operating in the country. Relations between UNRWA and Israel have long been tense, but have deteriorated sharply since the start of the conflict in Gaza, with Israel claiming that some of the agency's staff were involved in the Hamas attacks last year. That's the world tonight. I'm Julian Warwicker, back tomorrow at 10. But from me and everyone on the programme, good night.
Hallo, an dieser Stelle ein kleiner Hörtipp von mir. Ich bin Diane Hielscher und ich mache den Podcast Länger gut leben. Und dabei starten wir gemeinsam gut in den Tag. Und für den November habe ich mir was ganz Besonderes einfallen lassen. Der ist nämlich so dunkel und kalt. Und deswegen machen wir im November jeden Tag gemeinsam ein neues Morgenritual. Also wir wachen zusammen auf, trinken zum Beispiel Wasser mit Zitronensaft, wir stretchen uns, wir meditieren, wir machen eine Visualisierung, wir bewegen uns ein bisschen. Jeden Morgen neu, ab November. Abonniere uns jetzt schon, damit du keine Folge verpasst und dann mit mir gut in den Tag startest. Dein Podcast für einen guten Start in den Tag? Länger gut leben.